Good morning. The House Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil Law is in order. We don't have a quorum, and it's my intention to work as many of these bills as possible to a work session. We don't need a quorum for the public hearings, so I'm going to call the bills in the order they are on the agenda for public hearings, and as we get a quorum, we'll come back and open work sessions. So, Council, you want to tell us about Senate Bill 106A?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 106A had a public hearing on the 25th, which was continued at that time in the midst of a discussion about the provision of the measure that would prevent an elderly or disabled person from filing a restraining order against a conservator, their conservator or guardian. The bill itself, to refresh your recollection, is the Elder Abuse Bill. It has effect on the reporting statute, the definition of abuse, the restraining order relief provision, and also the passage of property from an elderly or incapacitated person to a person that's responsible for their physical or financial abuse. There are two amendments, and I believe we did not take action on either of those amendments. One is the Dash 5, which has to do with long-term care facilities being able to be provided notice of sex offenders who are residing in the facilities, and also would permit them to refuse admission or to transfer or discharge a resident who has been adjudicated as a sex offender. And the Dash 3 amendment, the other amendment, is a court amendment that applies to the type of relief that can be provided pursuant to the restraining order to prevent abuse of an elderly or disabled person. I gave my opinion last at the last hearing that this is really a clarifying amendment that represents some tighter language that the Judicial Department offered.
Okay, we have one witness from the Oregon Judicial Department. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the subcommittee. I am Belissa Seidlick, Family Law Senior Policy Analyst with the Oregon Judicial Department, and I'd like to thank the Chair for continuing the public hearing to provide us an opportunity to address some of the concerns that were raised in testimony at the May 25th hearing by Mr. Kopp in particular. And Judge Claudia Burton is a judge in Marion County Circuit Court. She's been providing input to the work group during the progress of this bill and really regrets that she was not able to be here. She couldn't, with this late notice, juggle her case schedules. However, she did provide written testimony. In particular, and this supplements the written testimony that was distributed at the last hearing on May 25th, and her supplemental testimony addresses the whole issue of why paragraph 8 on page 3 of the engrossed bill is a good idea and should remain in the bill. In particular, she points out that there is already statutory oversight of guardians and conservators in Chapter 125 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. And judges have ample authority to take immediate action if a fiduciary is conducting him or herself inappropriately. I have distributed copies of particular sections of the statutes that are relevant in this regard that demonstrate this broad authority. ORS 125.025 sets forth broad powers that the court has to investigate, require explanations, and to remove a fiduciary if necessary. And one of the most powerful aspects of this is that the court can act on its own motion. So if, as Judge Burton points out, a family member or a friend submits a letter or makes a telephone call indicating some kind of concern about what the fiduciary is doing, the court on its own motion can initiate action. ORS 125.085 also sets forth that a wide variety of persons who might be interested in the affairs and welfare of the protected person can raise concerns to the court. And again, the court can take notice of this and proceed on its own motion. 125.225 and .600 set forth the broad powers for the court to remove a fiduciary and appoint a temporary one in that prior fiduciary's place to take immediate action if necessary. And, of course, there are the annual final accountings that are required and a bond so that if a fiduciary depletes the estate of a protected person in without rational reason or without justification, the bond can be available to protect the vulnerable person. So if a person has legitimate concerns about the conduct of a conservator or a guardian, there are plenty of options on the probate side of matters for a judge to act. And Judge Burton points out in her testimony some of the problems that might happen if we were to permit a restraining order against a guardian or conservator. You would have different judges taking a look at different issues and maybe the same issues as well. We don't know, because at the ex parte stage of a protective order, you only have information from one side. The possibility of conflicting orders is also very prominent in such a situation. Assuming a restraining order is granted, how would that affect the underlying probate case? Would the judge immediately have to dismiss or remove the existing fiduciary who would manage the protected person's affairs in the meantime? And if a guardian or conservator is successful in defending him or herself in both of these proceedings, would the estate pay the cost for representation? So in conclusion, there's no doubt that there are individuals who, including protected persons, who are unhappy with the actions of their guardians or conservators, and they can and do accuse them of abuse. But as Judge Burton's testimony points out and the existing statutes show, the court already has full authority to address these concerns. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Fine. Thank you for your help. And you and I did discuss this earlier, and I thought it would be best if you could bring in the statutes where under which the court already has the authority that we're looking for to handle particular matters with respect to guardians and conservatorships. So I appreciate you bringing that forward. Are there questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Garrard.
Yes.
Is that basically what A5 is dealing with?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Garrard, A5 is not the court amendment. That has to do with, actually, I'm not prepared to address what it entails. It was addressed in the prior hearing, and I do think there are persons here who could testify on it.
I think counsel could answer that for you.
Okay. Chair Ackerman, Representative Garrard, the A5 amendment would require state agencies to notify long-term care facilities if they know that a person who is a sex offender is seeking admission to a long-term care facility. It would give the long-term care facility authority to refuse admission to a person who has been convicted as a sex offender, and it would permit the long-term care facility to discharge a resident pursuant to rules that are to be set up by the Department of Human Services if they discover that the person is a sex offender.
Mr. Chair, my question basically is, are the amendments dealing with the objection that we're
having? No. It's a clarification, because Section 8 on page 3 said in the boldface that the elderly person or disabled person could not file a petition against a guardian or conservator under particular statutes. And what we're trying to say is that the reason why that's there is because this is covered in the probate code, where they have adequate remedies against a guardian or conservator.
I was trying to take a shortcut, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
By asking you rather than reading everything. So.
Right.
And I got caught. So.
Any other questions, Representative? All right. Any other? Thank you very much for your testimony. I think the point's well taken. And I appreciate the materials that you provided for us. Are there any further witnesses on Senate Bill 106A? Seeing none, then I will conclude the public hearing on Senate Bill 106A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 115. Counsel?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 115 presents an opportunity for you to repeal a statute that is currently on the books. There is a 1987 law at Chapter 486 of the Oregon Laws, 1987, Section 1. This law requires the Department of Corrections to provide ongoing medical care to individuals who, as inmates, participated in radiation experiments under the supervision of Dr. Carl Heller and others at the Oregon State Penitentiary from 1958 until the early 1970s. These were Cold War federal government-sponsored hormone and radiation treatment studies that were performed on inmates. In October of 2000, a class of about 67 inmates settled a class action lawsuit against the state that arose out of the experiments. And as a condition of that settlement, the plaintiffs, the inmates, that is, or former inmates, agreed to relieve the state of its obligation under this law that I cited to provide ongoing medical treatment. I noted in the settlement agreement that not only did they agree to relieve the state of that obligation, but they agreed to, if requested, come to the legislature and ask for this statute to be repealed. The bill comes to us from the Department of Corrections, and there are no amendments, and the measure passed the Senate 25-0 with 5 excused.
Thank you. Do we have witnesses for, yes, one witness on Senate Bill 115. I'd like to come forward, please.
Chair Ackerman and members of the House Judiciary Civil Law Subcommittee, good morning. My name is Stan Zerniak. I'm Assistant Director for Operations for the Oregon Department of Corrections. And I'd like to say that Counsel O'Leary really did a very, very thorough job of covering the particulars of this bill. Beginning in 1958, the federal government sponsored hormone and radiation treatment studies on inmate volunteers in several prisons throughout the nation. Inmates volunteered and were paid for their participation in this experiment. As noted by Counsel O'Leary, Dr. Carl Heller and others conducted these experiments, and they were discontinued in the early 1970s. Following this discontinue, there were two laws that were enacted in Oregon that pertained to inmates who participated in them. The first law gave the inmates a right to ongoing medical monitoring and right to follow-up care at the expense of the state, even after release. And just for the committee's information, currently we have two inmates that are still in the Department of Corrections that were subjects to this experiment, and two former inmates that have been released that we know of out in the community. The second law prohibited further medical psychiatric or psychological experimentation or research with inmates in the department or in Department Corrections institutions. Senate Bill 115 would repeal the first law but not the second. And as noted, there was a suit that was filed and we settled that suit in 2001, and the state was required to pay a lump sum that was distributed among the inmate participants in exchange for the inmate's release of all claims against the state and individual defendants and a waiver of their rights under state law to further state pay compensation. Also, as noted by Counsel O'Leary, as a part of the settlement, plaintiffs, if requested by defendants, were to make a reasonable effort to support legislation to repeal these laws. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be willing to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee?
Curious about the history. The staff measure summary refers to a class of 67 surviving inmates, and I thought I heard you reference two people who continue to be inmates and two others who have been released. Is the 67 a broader range than just Oregon inmates? Is that how do those numbers square out?
I can answer. Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, my understanding, and I have the settlement agreement if you'd like to review it, is that the 67 number that I referenced to made up the class for the class action, and that not all of those inmates, former inmates, were at the time still currently in the custody of the Department of Corrections, but they all came out of the Department of Corrections. This was all, this was an Oregon state class action, and all of these individuals were at one time committed to the Department of Corrections and participated in these experiments. One of the issues that came up on the Senate side was, please tell us how many, if any, of these individuals are still inmates at the Oregon Department of Corrections, because the Senate committee wanted to clarify that the Department of Corrections did not intend to no longer give medical care to any individuals who were currently within their custody. The department made that clarification and stated on the Senate side that they did intend to do so. So I'm sorry, that's probably more like the answer than what you were looking for.
I was just trying to reconcile a couple of numbers, because I thought I heard Mr. Zerniak refer to two current inmates and two former inmates, and then I saw 67 in the staff measure summary, so I was just trying to reconcile those numbers. And the answer is that there are actually 65 former inmates, minus maybe a few little, some people who've died.
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, there were 67 surviving former inmates in the class. Okay. And the information that was provided on the Senate side, and I think that Mr. Cherniak just testified to, that two remain in DOC custody.
Right. Chair Ackerman and Representative McPherson, let me try to clarify also on my answer or my testimony earlier. I think that what happened was that when we first introduced this bill, we had four inmates in the system. Two of those have since been released back out in the community.
I see. The second reference to two was people who had in the meantime been released.
Right.
Gotcha. Thank you very much.
We got the record clarified. Thank you very much. Any further questions from the committee? Seeing none, we thank you for your testimony. Any further witnesses on Senate Bill 115? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 115 and open a work session on Senate Bill 115. Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 115 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard moves that Senate Bill 115 be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion from the committee? Seeing none, the clerk may call a roll.
Aye. Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth excused. Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Senate Bill 115 is referred to the full committee for the due pass recommendation, and the work session on that bill is concluded. I think I'll go back, Representative Flores, to Senate Bill 106A. We did not have a quorum. And now we do, so we're going to go back and infill, and I will open a work session on the Senate Bill 106A. Do you need some background, Representative? I can have counsel summarize. We have to do the A3 and A5 amendments. Testimony was only related to Section 8, I think, on page 3, that prohibited a protected a person from getting a restraining order against a guardian or a conservator, and the representative, a witness, testified that those types of claims are adequately protected under the probate code, and you should have references to those statutes in your file.
And Mr. Chair, I might just volunteer that I think that would be focus on that section
8 was in response to a question that I had raised, which was in response to another witness, Mr. Kopp, who had came and testified, you may recall, last week, saying, why are we taking away this remedy? And the response then, which was sufficient to persuade me, is that there is an adequate protection through another system of court supervision of guardianships, and that it would be complicating to the process, as demonstrated in the correspondence we got from Judge Burton, to have two separate remedies going on for the same kind of problem.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to ask Representative McPherson. Mr. Cobb's testimony indicated that that system may not be working. And that's the question I'm wrestling with on this bill. Is it doing the job at this point? And if it is, why would he feel so, and as I recall his testimony, he was very adamant that we're not protecting some of these elderly folks. That's my only question with this bill.
I think we have, you know, in the legislative process, we have propositions that are not evidence-based, they're anecdotal, they're just, you know, the way people feel about things or things that have been told. I can only say that with my experience and that the courts, at least in Lane County, have tremendous supervision over these files. Not only do they have a judge assigned to probate duties, they have a probate clerk that does all the preliminary work on handling all the filings and all the accountings. And I know that if you get in default with the court, not in default, but if you get behind in filing your accountings, you're summoned in by the court's own motion for a show cause hearing as to why you're not getting your work done, the accountings and whatever. So I would say that, at least from my familiarity, that the court system is very, very conscientious about their duties here.
Okay.
But that's just my testimony, I suppose.
That's what I was looking for.
Anyone have any comments on that might know from the audience? Okay. Further discussion on the bill. Okay, hearing done. We will have to do the A3 amendments first, Council.
That's right.
I'll need a motion on the A3s.
Mr. Chair, I would move the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 106.
Representative Flores moves that the the dash 3 amendments.
Dash 3.
I'm sorry, I said A3. Dash 3 amendments be incorporated within the bill. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, that's allowed. Need a motion on the dash 5s.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 106A.
Okay, Representative Flores moves the dash 5s be incorporated within Senate Bill 106A. Discussion? Objection? Hearing none, that's allowed. And on the main motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 106A to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that Senate Bill 106A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. And then discussion? Any objections? Clerk, may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Worth, excuse. Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Senate Bill 106A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and the work session on that bill is concluded. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 181A. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 181A comes to you from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. This has to do with inmate lawsuits against public bodies. Currently, there is a statute that permits the court to waive or to defer the filing fees for an inmate who seeks to bring a lawsuit against a public body, but the decision about whether to waive those fees may only be based on the inmate's financial situation, that is, their ability to pay. This would add another factor for the court to consider in determining whether or not to waive the fees, and that is it would permit the court to review the inmate's pleadings at the time of filing and determine whether or not the pleadings fail to state a claim. If the court would determine that the pleadings fail to state a claim, then regardless of the inmate's financial situation, the court would be permitted the discretion to decline to waive the fees on behalf of the inmate.
Okay, thank you. We have one witness, Greg Prince. Do you want to come forward? While you're taking your seat, Senate Bill 106A and Senate Bill 115, the persons that made the representatives that made the main motions will be the carriers. Mr. Prince?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Craig Prince on behalf of the Criminal Justice Commission. Counsel O'Leary, I think, very aptly summarized Senate Bill 181. It comes from the Systems Review of the Governor's Public Safety Review. Unfortunately, Judge Terry Leggert, Marion County Circuit Judge, was unable to make it. She would have been able to do a lot better job of explaining the need for this bill because she, I believe, hears a lot of these claims. Very simply, this is an attempt at trying to unclog some of the system by having a judge review claims by inmates and letting the judges know that they may look at the merits of the case, and if the pleadings fail to state a claim for which relief may be granted, the court may decline to waive or defer filing fees or court costs. I think that the testimony in the Senate was that there was it was not clear whether or not they were able to do so. Originally, the bill took a harder stand. It said, I believe, that the if there was no claim stated, that the court could not waive. And through the process in the Senate, we modified that down to make it discretionary upon the judge's review. So if you have any other questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them, but that's the bill. And I ask for your support for it, and it comes from the review.
Questions for the committee? I have one. What are these mostly 1983 claims that are being filed that we're getting at?
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding.
All right. I think the federal court system has the same problem.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct. I think the federal courts in many states already have this type of language. But I think, as I recall, Judge Leggert's testimony, that is the type of claim.
Do you know, Mr. Prince, if the federal system even goes further? I think it does. I think that maybe the court enters some sort of an order and informs the plaintiff what it needs to do, what he or she needs to do to make the complaint complete, and if there's a timeline, then it's dismissed. Am I reading this correctly? It's been a long time since I've looked at that.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct. I believe the language as originally put in by Judge Leggert was more along the federal system, the way they do it. We took it back a notch and made it discretionary. But I believe you're correct, and that's just from my memory of the testimony in the Senate.
Okay. I didn't know if that was a matter that was considered when, as the bill was being prepared, to take the next step and actually enter an order informing the plaintiff what to do, and then if that doesn't happen in terms of the pleadings, the case would be dismissed. Did you just have that discussion, or is that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think we had that discussion, and I don't know. I wish Judge Leggert was here, because I don't know if that would resolve the problem, which would that beget more litigation, or would it? Or would it do what this is aiming to do, which is if you're going to file a claim that is poorly pled, does not state a claim, then at least it's not going to be free to the inmate. And so I don't know if that would solve that or not.
Yeah, I just wonder if it was under discussion. It seems like it might be the next step as this would evolve. Mm-hmm. Okay, further questions then from the committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson?
Do inmates, Mr. Prince, ever pay the filing fee themselves, or do these cases just not go forward if the fee isn't waived?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, I don't know the answer to that, but as you can see from the section, I mean, I would think, certainly it's possible that an inmate would have a trust account from which they could pay the fees, and as you can see, a employee of the Department of Corrections, after certifies whether or not the statement of the inmate that they have no way to pay, they certify whether or not that is true. I think the representatives from the Department of Corrections left, but certainly there are some inmates that do have trust accounts, and I think those would pay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let me understand the consequence of this then. If the waiver is of a fee is denied, and the court has made a preliminary ruling on the sufficiency of the complaint, what happens to the case? It seems like it's filed, but it's not filed.
Mr. Chairman, I was talking to... it serves as a limited judgment, which I believe is... and I was talking to Ms. Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission, because this is not my area of expertise. So I might add, if it's a limited judgment, I think it's appealable, but it's not my area. I'm not an appellate lawyer, so I don't know that answer to that.
Yeah, it just seems sort of ironic that you say, well, I'm denying your fee waiver. We're not going to let you file a complaint because you don't qualify for the waiver, but I've already made a preliminary ruling on the case. But maybe that's one of the ironies we have to live with. Okay. Further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative?
Noticing, however, in subsection 6 of the bill, friend 6, nothing in this section shall be construed as preventing an inmate from bringing an action against a public body because the inmate has no assets or means by which to pay the initial partial filing fee as prescribed under this or provided under this section. So they're not barred from bringing a claim.
No.
So there must be a consideration of some asset that would allow them to bring a claim, mm-hmm. an action. Would that be correct?
I think so. They still could. Okay, further questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Prince. Are there any further witnesses on Senate Bill 181A?
Where's my sheet?
Mr. Snyder, please come forward. I didn't mean to hold you up there, but you weren't on our witness list, and so I was wondering, what did I do with it? Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I originally signed up before, but didn't today, and so I just wanted an opportunity to put on the record our support for the bill. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and for the reasons already identified by Mr. Prince, we support this bill.
You support the bill?
Yes, sir.
That's your testimony?
That's it.
Good to hear from the counties. Any questions of Mr. Snyder? Shortest testimony on record. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
This session. Any further short witnesses on Senate Bill 181A? Seeing none, then I will conclude the public hearing on Senate Bill 181A and open a work session on that bill. Motion from Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 181A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard moves that Senate Bill 181A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth excused. Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Senate Bill 181 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with Representative Garrard as carrier. And I'll close the work session on that bill and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 230A.
Council? Chair Ackerman, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 230A comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. This bill has to do with the process by which a guardian ad litem can be appointed to represent a parent in a juvenile dependency proceeding or termination of parental rights proceeding. The bill sets up the process for the appointment, the details regarding the hearing to determine whether or not a guardian ad litem will be appointed, the standard by which the court must determine whether or not the guardian ad litem will be appointed. It identifies the duties of the guardian ad litem. It identifies who is to pay for the guardian ad litem and a process for removal of the guardian ad litem. There
there's an A4 amendment in your packet that is a revision of the original language concerning the process for appointment, the standard by which the court determines whether or not to appoint, and the hearing at which the court determines whether or not to appoint. The concept, though, is the same. The standard is if the court finds by a preponderance of the evidence that due to the parent's mental or physical disability or impairment, that the parent lacks substantial capacity either to understand the nature and consequences of the proceeding or to give direction and assistance to their attorney, that the appointment is necessary to protect the rights of the parent in the proceeding. The measure passed the Senate 18-11 with one opposed. The opposition in the Senate, I would note, was to the original bill without the A4 amendment, and the opposition was led mostly by Senator Beyer, who was instrumental in formulating the A4 amendment with the assistance of Deputy Attorney General Michael Livingston, who has signed up to testify to the bill.
Thank you, Counsel. We have three witnesses, Wendy Johnson, Richard Livingston, and Julie McFarlane.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm wondering, for the non-attorney here on the dais, if you would give me a definition of guardian ad litem.
Counsel, do you speak Latin?
Chair Ackerman, having been trained in good Catholic schools most of my life, I happen to.
I took 2 years of it in high school, and this is the first time I've ever used it.
I think we determined that ad litem means for purposes of the case, or possibly for purposes of litigation. So how that practically applies is that the guardian ad litem is the person who stands in the place of the litigant and makes the decisions that the litigant would otherwise make. And in this case, it's because the litigant himself or herself is incapacitated due to mental incapacity or physical incapacity in such a way that they're not able to make those decisions.
Thank you. It's also commonly allowed in cases of minors because they lack the capacity to sue, so they have to have a guardian ad litem appointed. Not a general guardian, but one for the purposes of guiding the litigation.
Thank you.
Okay. Witnesses, how would you like to proceed?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. I would just want to briefly explain why the Law Commission has this bill before you today, and then there is an amendment to the bill that Michael Livingston from the Department of Justice worked on, and he will explain that provision. And then my research assistant from the Law Commission, Jason Jansen, helps throughout the project. And so if there are any other questions of the bill, perhaps he can help. Julie McFarland from the Juvenile Rights Project chaired this project, and she's unable to make it as of now. So I'm without the expert on the bill, but I think we'll be able to handle it. I just want to explain sort of in layman's terms why we have this bill, and it's because there is not a provision in the Oregon statutes presently that lays out the process for appointing a guardian ad litem in a juvenile case, and it doesn't explain the standards, and there's a lack of guidance for guardians as well as attorneys and parents and the courts in this area. But the first question is, why do you appoint a guardian for a parent? And that's because there may be a parent who doesn't have the capacity to represent themselves adequately in a case. And there has been a great deal of litigation in the last few years regarding this area. And in 2003, in particular, there was a Court of Appeals opinion that came down that said that a guardian ad litem had the right to make decisions in a case when the parent did not show up, but the guardian ad litem showed up in that case. That's the Juvenile Department versus Cooper case. And so the issues regarding when a guardian ad litem is to be appointed and how long that appointment lasts and what decisions they can make has been floating around, and folks were looking for guidance, and that's why we have this case. In fact, the Court of Appeals has held that it's a violation of a parent's due process rights to not appoint a guardian if they're mentally incompetent. So that's why there is a need. But you do have to balance the parent's rights, because these are significant rights if you're terminating a parent's rights. And so you'll see that there's a balancing in this bill. So that's briefly the reason for the need in this bill, and the work group was composed of folks from the defense bar and the state side, the DAs and the Department of Justice, as well as the courts. And so it was a well-represented work group, and as well as having guardians on the board groups to really struggle with the issues on how the process should work effectively. With that, I'll just turn it over to explain the amendments to the bill.
Thank you. Next.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the case that Wendy described is a good example.
State your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Michael Livingston, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Justice. The case that Ms. Johnson described, the Cooper case, is a good example of the kind of case in which the need for a guardian arises. The mother in that case, because of her mental illness, experienced periods of time where she was just non-responsive to the judicial process involved with her child, not only with the juvenile court jurisdiction proceedings, but then later the termination proceedings. That although that's not the only case, that would be the most typical one in which a guardian might be appointed. Also, the guardian may or may not need to be appointed for the entire period of the proceedings. For example, if a person has a mental illness, it can be addressed by medication, but because of the person's failure to take medication, the person is not attending to or responsive to the proceedings, the guardian would be appointed for that period. The main problem that this bill addresses, that the Cooper case was based on, is what powers or authorities does the guardian have? And the bill spells out very clearly what those are. In the Cooper case, the mother was required to appear at a pre-hearing and a termination case. The mother did not appear personally, but the guardian did. And the guardian said, "I'm here representing the mother and her rights, and we want a trial on this petition." The juvenile court in that case said, "I'm sorry, the mother was required to be here personally. We're going to go ahead and proceed with the trial at this time." The Court of Appeals reversed that decision, saying that the guardian ad litem basically stood in the shoes of the parent for purposes of that proceeding. This bill makes that clear, what the authority of the guardian ad litem is and is not, and so we won't have a repeat of the Cooper case. The other provisions of the bill that are important, and I'll talk about those right now with respect to the amendments, are outlining the processes by which a guardian is appointed. There are two methods by which the guardian can be appointed. One, on a motion of a party showing facts that, if proved, would establish that it's more likely than not that because of a parent's impairment or disability, the parent can't participate meaningfully in the proceeding. The judge, on his or her own motion, also can set a hearing on that question. In other words, even if no party raises the question, if in the opinion of the judge there is an impairment or a disability that affects the ability of the parent to protect his or her rights, the judge can order a hearing on that question. No guardian can be appointed except after a hearing and based on the evidence presented at the hearing. The amendments that you have before you, the A4 amendments, were primarily drafted based on discussions that I had with Senator Beyer, and his primary concern about the bill as drafted was this. The bill says that the rules of evidence, except for those relating to privileges, do not apply in these proceedings. The practical reason for that is so that you can allow reliable hearsay in these proceedings. These proceedings sometimes have to be set very quickly, and even in the middle of a termination case, and in order to get expert evidence into the record, if the people were required to actually show up and be live witnesses, those hearings could be put off for great periods of time and slow down the process. Senator Beyer felt that that affected the reliability of the evidence, notwithstanding the need to streamline this process. And so, pursuant to the conversations that he and I had, and I'm sure there are others who shared his concerns, I just worked with him directly, we drafted some amendments. And the first one has to do with the reliability of the evidence, and that's on page 2, lines 6 through 14 of the A4 amendments. Under the bill, the rules of evidence, as I said, concerning privileges apply, but not the other evidence. What rules of evidence? What we added to the bill was a requirement that not only must the evidence be relevant
to the question whether the guardian should be appointed, that is, relate to the disability or incapacity of the parent. But it also must be, quote, the type commonly relied upon by reasonably prudent persons in the conduct of their serious affairs. That goes to the reliability of the evidence. Let me give you an example. If you had the hospital report of a psychiatrist who had been treating the parent, and the report was submitted as evidence, and the report was an accurate copy of what was in the record, that would be this type of reliability. If you had the testimony, on the other hand, of a person who claimed to have seen the record and was unrelated to the case, even though that person was giving the same information, that would not be reliable. That's an example of what that standard means. And this standard, by the way, comes directly from the Administrative Procedures Act. This is the standard for reliability of evidence that's admissible in contested case proceedings under the APA. So it is a standard with which parties would be familiar, and it has some case law behind it to say what that is. So I think that addition really addresses both Senator Beyer's concerns, which are legitimate, about the reliability of the evidence in these important proceedings, and at the same time preserves the goal of moving the case along, because there are parties other than just the parent whose rights are at issue here, those being the children. The second change is on page 2, lines 15 and 16, states what I think is obvious but is important to state expressly nonetheless, and that is that the decision to appoint a guardian must be based on the evidence presented at the hearing. In other words, not on the observations of someone outside the hearing, but on the evidence actually presented. The third change on page 2, lines 17 to 23, adds the term impairment to the previous term disability. Disability may be a term of art in some cases, and we didn't want, by using that term of art, to exclude other circumstances where a parent would be incapacitated, and so we added the term impairment. And then the second change in that section adds, again, something that should be implicit in the language but is important to make express, and that is, quote, the appointment of a guardian ad litem is necessary to protect the parent's rights in the proceeding during the period of the parent's incapacity and impairment. That's an important addition, I think, because it means that if the parent's impairment or disability is transient, that means if it's going to get better, if the parent can take medication and no longer need a guardian ad litem, then you don't have a situation where the guardian ad litem is appointed at the beginning and stays throughout the whole proceeding without any method of reviewing that appointment. And that there already were in the bill provisions allowing for that decision to be reassessed. This just, again, makes it clear that the court must make a finding that appointment of a guardian ad litem is necessary during that period. A final change that really was not part of the discussions with Senator Beyer, but after further review appeared to be necessary, was to the what I call the motion practice, and those are on page 1, lines 3 through 24, and page 2, lines 1 through 4. The bill as originally written made it sound like there were two motions that had to be filed, one for a hearing on the question of a guardian, and two, one for appointment of a guardian. That was somewhat confusing, and so this language just clarifies those proceedings. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
We'll try those after we try our next witness. So.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Jason Jansen. I really don't have anything to add to what's already been said. I think they've done a fine job of presenting what Ms. McFarland would have presented if she had been here.
Okay, so you favor the bill?
Of course.
As amended. Thank you very much. Just want to get that on the record. Okay. Questions from the committee? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand what the relationship is between the appointment of a guardian ad litem for a parent in a termination of parental rights proceeding and the appointment of counsel provided at state expense to because of the indigent circumstances of the parent. Are they two different people, the guardian ad litem and the counsel appointed to represent? Help me out there.
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, yes, they are different people. The guardian ad litem, in effect, steps into the shoes of the parent, and so the attorney is still representing the parent, but consults with the guardian ad litem.
So, if I might, Mr. Chair, so what type of individual then serves as a guardian ad litem as opposed to indigent counsel for the parent?
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, actually the bill says who the court can appoint as a guardian ad litem, because it does take a special person who has the knowledge of working with people with disabilities. And so let me find the right section for you. It's in Section 3, Subsection 1. It just states that the guardian ad litem must be a licensed mental health professional or an attorney, and they must be familiar with legal standards relating to competence, and they have to have skills and experience in representing persons with such disabilities. And it's clear that the guardian ad litem cannot be a parent, a part of the parent's family, so that there's not a conflict of interest later.
If I might pursue this further, Mr. Chair, and I see that it has to be either a licensed mental health professional or attorney, and I guess it would appear to me we've got sort of multiple players in this situation. We've got, and would ever be the case that the counsel who's been appointed as because of the indigent condition of the parent would also be the guardian ad litem, or do we have then two parties? We have the guardian ad litem and counsel, both then appointed and assisting the parent in the situation.
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, they can never represent both, because in a termination case or dependency case, the main issue of the case is whether the parent is fit to continue as the parent of the child. And so you don't want to have both the parent, the attorney representing the parent trying to make sure they keep these children in effect or represent their client, while at the same time the guardian ad litem is assisting that parent with the decisions that the attorney is making. So that there have been Oregon State Bar opinions on the fact that an attorney cannot ask for a guardian ad litem to be appointed, because it'd be in the disinterest of the parent.
So, there's a proceeding to terminate parental rights, and the first thing that happens then is appointment of the counsel to assist that, because that's an indigent parent, we'll say. And then somebody, maybe that counsel, seeks the appointment of a guardian ad litem. Who is it that makes the decision that there needs to be a guardian ad litem?
Chair, Representative McPherson, either the bill states that either a party or the court on the motion can request a hearing regarding the issue of appointing a guardian ad litem for the parents. So in other words, the parent could request it, opposing counsel could, the court could.
And maybe counsel could help me out as well. It just seems like that we have a sort of multiplication of service providers here assisting with this situation, and it would seem that counsel to the parent would. I'm just wondering if there's anything that's conceptually wrong with the counsel also being the guardian ad litem.
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, speaking from my own experience, having worked as a court-appointed counsel in dependency cases and termination cases, it would. Court-appointed counsel would be very reticent, I think, to ask the court to have a hearing on whether or not their client, the parent, who counsel has an obligation to try to assert the and maintain the parental rights of, might not be competent to make decisions with respect to the termination proceeding. I think it'd be more likely that another party, although certainly court-appointed counsel could make that request, but I think it would be more likely that another party to the proceeding or the judge himself or herself would make that request and call the hearing. Under this bill, it's clear that it's the judge who makes that determination. And then the next step is that you're raising is who serves that role. And again, relying on my experience as court-appointed counsel in dependency and termination matters, it would present an ethical minefield for court-appointed counsel to serve both as legal counsel to that parent and guardian ad litem to that parent. And I don't know that has ever been done in practice. Due to state law right now, there's no statute. The court is acting under its inherent authority when it appoints. But I think that attorneys have been appointed, other attorneys who represent parents in dependency cases, but certainly not who are participating in that particular case, have been appointed. And I think this expands and clarifies that an attorney with experience in mental health issues could be appointed, as could a mental health expert himself or herself be appointed.
Well, then, if I could pursue this, if the guardian ad litem then is appointed at, say, the initiative of the court, mm-hmm. then does there... And let's say that guardian ad litem is an attorney, which is permitted under the bill. Then that would seem to serve the whole need. Would the previously engaged court-appointed counsel then withdraw from the case?
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, no. I think the answer is that that they are not one and the same, because the court-appointed counsel must continue to advocate on behalf of the client and serve as advocate, but the court-appointed counsel cannot, in my opinion, cross the line into making decisions on behalf of the incapacitated client, because that is the thing. I think that is the situation that would present, at best, a potential conflict of interest, at worst, an actual conflict of interest, and that's why it would be necessary to have a separate individual serving in the place of the client, making the decisions that the client would otherwise make. I know that Mr. Travis, who's here from the Judicial Department, has a much greater breadth of experience in this issue than I, and has stepped up to the witness stand, and I think wants to speak to this issue,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I would welcome some guidance here.
Thank you, Mr. O'Leary. To amplify Representative McPherson on what Mr. O'Leary just said, I'm Timothy Travis from the Oregon Judicial Department, and I was involved in writing this bill, and I have represented clients in juvenile court for longer than I care to state. Lawyers have clients. Lawyers are not clients. And conceptually, a lawyer in a termination case looks to a client to guide the lawyer about what decisions should be made in the case. There are ethical spheres, if you will, of control of a legal case. Lawyers control some things that happen in court. Clients control other things that happen in court. Lawyers are very, in the word that Mr. O'Leary used, reticent about invading the sphere of the client, okay, in terms of the decisions that are about to be made. The lawyers who represent parents in dependency cases and termination cases were really the prime movers in getting this legislation going, because of their reluctance to act as their own client. In other words, they look to someone to guide them. A mental health professional or a lawyer who is trained in mental health issues is the natural person to substitute for the disabled person, because that's a person who, from the point of view of their training, the orientation of their training, they are able to help the lawyer try to get to where the parents would want to go if the parent were there and able to assist the attorney. Does that help?
Namely, and I appreciate your giving me the assistance here, and I can understand that the initial court-appointed indigent counsel who is representing
and looking to their client, the parent, that person, I can see how they would be disqualified from then serving as the guardian ad litem, which is my first thought. Well, why have any kind of break in the continuity of the relationship? But once there's a guardian ad litem appointed, that individual is making the decisions for the parent because the determination has been made that the parent can't represent themselves or can't make their own decisions. And at that point, if that's an attorney, then one person could do that job. The other indigent counsel is out of the picture, and it seems like we have the efficiency of having one person kind of making all the decisions. Under this bill, we have to either have a licensed mental health professional or an attorney serving as guardian ad litem. If we have the former, then we have to have new counsel representing the guardian ad litem, and we have, I think, two individuals who are paid for at state expense.
Correct.
Handling this arrangement, and this is on top of a piece of information I picked up during the, I think, early part of this session, which is that in the termination of parental rights, we also have court-appointed counsel for the children.
Sometimes we do.
In many instances, and so we have kind of a multiplication of players involved in this process, and that's really the line of questioning. I'm really going at whether we're being as efficient as we can be about how we get the right level of expertise brought to bear, recognizing that we have, you know, ethical obligations.
Right.
To the council has ethical obligations.
Well, before I turn the mic over to Mr. Livingston, who knows as much if not more about this whole stuff than I do, first let me say that in the law, efficiency is not always the highest value. In the law, often there are situations in which redundancies serve justice in ways that efficiencies can't. But a practical, less pontificating answer to your question is, once you get that second attorney, let's say, who is trained in mental health issues and such on board as the guardian ad litem, termination of parental rights, juvenile court cases, child abuse neglect cases in general, are part of one of the most esoteric areas of the law that there is. I don't know very many attorneys who are cross-trained in mental health issues and in termination of parental rights law. The juvenile code is a very complicated and very specialized area of the law. So even if we didn't have the ethical conflict of the separate domains, and even if we were willing to say in this particular case that less is more and we would be more efficient, as a practical matter, I don't know that you're going to find an attorney who would be competent in all the mental health issues and competent to conduct a termination of parental rights trial. So for those three kind of factors working together. But I think the highest value here is the ethical domains. It's the domain of the client and the domain of the attorney. Decisions are to be made by one or the other, but not by one and the other. So if that helps, fine. But Mr. Livingston, can you get me out of this?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson. 2 points. One is a clarification that I wanted to make I said earlier, is that these guardianship proceedings apply at any stage of the
right.
case, not just termination. The termination was an example.
I understand.
And secondly, Section 3, subsections 3 and 4 of the bill outline or list the decisions that and the type of choices that the guardian ad litem has to make. Those are decisions that an attorney in a way can't make. And let me give you an example. One of the things a guardian ad litem can do is listed in subsection 3, small c, make decisions concerning the adoption of a child of the parent, including release or surrender. Not infrequently in a termination case, the parent being confronted with the weight of the evidence or with the condition of the child makes a choice not to fight the termination. This is without a guardian ad litem, but just in the normal case. And instead to release the child to be adopted by a new parent. An attorney for that parent, again, the incapacitated parent, just take that hypothetical, might give that parent the different options available, but would never make the choice for that parent. And I think that that example may be a good one for the dilemma or the paradox here of having more than one legal representative. What the guardian ad litem does, as I understand it, that the attorney can't do, is make the final call on those choices. The attorney can give the legal advice and the options and say, do you want to go this way? Do you want to fight the termination case? Or do you want to go the other way? It's not the attorney's role to say, this is the choice you will make, or this is the choice you should make. At least that is the model. Now, granted, it may not always happen that way, but I think that's the model, not only for the guardian ad litem here, but the guardian ad litem in any case. For example, the wrongful death case where the child is a surviving relative of two parents who are killed in an automobile accident, and because of the child is a minor, can't bring the action himself or herself, and has a guardian ad litem to make those choices. And I think that's the ethical and the ethical split in the case. And I don't think, Lord knows, if there were any way to have economy in the juvenile court system and to save money and have it well spent, you know, the folks here would certainly be able to do it. But it's that fundamental dilemma that the lawyer simply can't make the choice. He can give the choices, but can't make them, I think, that causes us to have that, what appears to be a duplicative effort.
Go ahead. You cut me off at some point if I'm just wasting the committee's time here, but I'm curious. Does this? We have indigent counsel appointed for the parent, and then we have a guardian ad litem appointed. Am I reading this correctly? That there's still that original counsel is still representing the parent, even though a guardian ad litem has been appointed, and that guardian ad litem, if that person is not legally trained, has separate counsel appointed. Am I right about that?
No.
Okay.
No. I'm sorry. The guardian ad litem who is appointed would be represented by the attorney who was represented to appoint.
So there aren't two court-appointed attorneys.
I'm sorry.
There is a guardian ad litem appointed at state expense, and there's counsel.
Correct.
But there aren't two counsel.
That original attorney now looks to the guardian ad litem rather than looking to the parent.
I think another potential conflict of interest is in Section 5 on page 2, where you provide that the parent's attorney shall inquire at every stage of the proceeding whether the parent's competence has changed, and if appropriate, can request removal of the guardian ad litem. So they have a basic conflict right there, actual conflict of interest over how to proceed with the continuation of the appointment. Okay, other questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess perhaps to Representative McPherson, and panel could perhaps help as well. Representative McPherson, your concerns seem to be focused on if, as and when, indigent defense counsel is appointed. Is it true that with that presumption, are the most cases for juvenile termination of parental rights or juvenile dependency proceedings, are they all indigent defense cases? They all are.
For the most part, yes.
I see.
Overwhelmingly.
Thank you.
Fine. Further questions? I don't want to prolong this either, but the further I get into this, the more I remember about juvenile law and the proliferation of people. The CASAs, were they ever considered as guardians ad litem, or they perform another distinct and separate role?
They were specifically, Representative Ackerman, they were specifically excluded from being guardians ad litem for the parent, because the role of the CASA is to investigate and advocate for the best interest of the child, and the child's best interest may well conflict with that of the parent.
Thank you. Okay, further discussion on, I've forgotten where we are, Senate Bill 230? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your participation this morning. I then will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 238, and we have to do the -4 amendments, is that correct, Counsel?
That's correct, Chair.
The Chair will move that the -4 amendments be incorporated within the main bill, that is Senate Bill 231A. Is there any discussion? Any objection? That's allowed. Chair will move that Senate Bill 230A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Bush, here, Chair Ackerman.
Aye.
Senate Bill 230A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I will be the carrier. And a work session on that bill is concluded, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 231A. Ms. Johnson, Mr. Livingston, repeat performance. Council, what about this bill?
Chair Ackerman, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 231A also comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. This has to do with the records that are produced in juvenile delinquency cases. There are records that are commonly referred to as the social file that courts commonly rely upon in making their decisions with respect to what is going to happen in a juvenile court case. And this bill clarifies who has access to the information in that social file. It clarifies that maintenance of the records in that social file must be done by the circuit court clerk. And it also clarifies that transcripts that are made of juvenile delinquency cases are subject to the same disclosure restrictions as would be with the records in the social file.
Thank you. Witnesses, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. This bill before you is regarding juvenile records, and you would think that something as basic as juvenile records would be clear in the code, but you have to look back at the history of the juvenile court, and the juvenile court has changed over time, and the juvenile department plays a different role than it did originally. And so there are not clear statutes on what the court is required to maintain and what is, in fact, the juvenile record, both at the trial level and then on appeal. Again, this was a work group composed of members from the defense bar, the DAs, the Department of Justice, the courts and such. And this bill received overwhelming support over on the Senate side and has worked through the process. This bill really will help streamline the process and make it clear to all parties what the record is. There are amendments before you today that are in response to issues raised by the Judicial Department, and Michael Livingston, who chaired this work group from the Department of Justice, will testify on both the substance of the bill as well as the need for this amendment. But again, it's a good bill, that it's a needed law reform bill to make the juvenile law code work.
Mr. Livingston.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Michael Livingston, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice. ORS 419A 255 1 and 2 governs the confidentiality of juvenile court records, which are maintained in either of one or the other of two files, one called the legal file, which includes motions, orders, and petitions, and the other euphemistically called the social file. In the social file are reports that have to do with the progress of the parents and also the history and prognosis of the children. These core provisions of that statute have remained unchanged essentially since 1959, when the Juvenile Code was enacted. It's been amended over the years piecemeal, but is in dire need of a comprehensive amendment, and that was our initial task and goal. However, after getting into that task, we realized that it couldn't be fixed. We had to go back to square one, and realizing that it was not possible to do that and have a bill presented to the legislature this session, we decided instead to address three very specific gaps, problems with that statute as a standalone bill to correct the problems now. Those three longstanding problems are the lack of express authority in the bill for some of the major parties in these cases to have access to these social file materials, the district attorney, OIA, and DHS. The bill expressly gives that authority. The other provision that relates to the parties' access is a provision authorizing those entities, the DA, OIA, and DHS, to share among themselves for in order to perform their duties in the case, that information. Those changes seem like they should already be in the statute, but they're not, and this bill puts them there. Second, the second longstanding problem is there is a lack of any requirement or procedure to ensure that these social history materials that are the basis for a number of court rulings are preserved and get to the Court of Appeals in the case of appeals. Let me give you an example. Once a child is found to be within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, there are a series of review hearings that take place to determine, among other things, whether the child needs to be in foster care, how the parents are doing. Many, if not all, of these hearings begin with the judge's reference to what's called a court report, which is submitted either by OYA or DHS, giving the history that since the previous hearing. Although all the parties have that report, and the court in large part bases its decision in the after the hearing on that report, these reports, because they're submitted pursuant to statute, are not made part of the record, and all across the state, different counties deal with those in different ways. Some counties preserve them in a separate file. We found that other counties are shredding them. And so because you have an automatic right, you have a right of appeal by statute from these hearings, we're confronted with a situation where if there's an appeal, many times we don't know where that report is, and that's going to be the basis for court, appellate court review of that of the decision. What this bill does, and the A2 amendments particularly, is set up the circumstances under which the court is responsible for making sure that if those reports are considered for purposes of a hearing, number one, they're identified, and number two, they're preserved in the case of an appeal. The third problem or uncertainty that this bill corrects is the question whether a transcript in these cases is confidential. Back in May of 2003, in response to a public records request, the Attorney General, in his role as the person who issues or denies public record orders, determined that transcripts under the statute of these proceedings are confidential and therefore part of the protected material under ORS 419A-255-1. What this bill does is state that expressly. And the reason that that's significant is the folks who are having to make these decisions at the local level are clerks and for example, the clerk of the juvenile court, the circuit court clerk. They shouldn't have to get an attorney general's opinion to know what's confidential and what isn't. So it's a very pragmatic addition. The A2 amendments solve one other problem, and this was identified by Jim Nass, the legal counsel to the appellate courts, and Chief Judge David Brewer. These court reports that I spoke of earlier, on which the juvenile court relies or considers in making an order in these cases, often are not offered or received into evidence. And what Mr. Nass and Judge Brewer pointed out is this bill makes it sound like we're creating some new body of information that, although it's not part of the evidentiary record, the Court of Appeals nevertheless considers. And what we did in working with Mr. Nass and Judge Brewer is say, okay, if the judge does consider these materials, and no one else has offered it as an exhibit or asked the court to take judicial notice, the juvenile court judge, subject to any objections that the parties may have, will cause it to be made an exhibit or take judicial notice of it and then make sure those records are available for appeal. Now, that might not seem like much, but let me tell you, over the last 3 or 4 years, we at the Department of Justice have had to spend many man hours and much of the state's money going back and finding these records and getting them up to the appellate courts. This bill makes that part of the law now and puts a process in place that the Judicial Department and all the parties are in agreement with. And what we've done, too, is we've left it up to each county how to maintain these files and how to cause them to be made part of the record. If the judge wants to return the documents to the parties and then in case of an appeal have the parties resubmit them, that's fine. So you don't have the counties taking up clerical space and clerical time in doing this. That's the bill and A2 amendments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I just have a small one. I assume you use the vehicle of judicial notice to incorporate in the juvenile court record documents that are not otherwise be there. I think we lawyers know what judicial notice is, but could you explain how that works and why that's the best vehicle under these circumstances?
Yes, thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Judicial notice is authorized by the Oregon Evidence Code, and for example, the court can take judicial notice of a statute. You don't actually have to have the paper copy of the statute, and what it is a way that the court can put a body of information into the record without actually having the document itself, and it's a streamlined process, and basically it goes to identify materials that where everyone has the same access to it. In these court reports, for example, all the parties would have copies of this, so the court could take judicial notice of, say, the psychological evaluation on pages 4 through 10 of the report. And that way also the court would not have to deal with the paperwork of stamping an exhibit and storing those exhibits somewhere. And we just that's in the bill in order, again, to allow the counties as much flexibility as possible in meeting these responsibilities.
Fine. Thank you for your answer. Are there other questions from the committee? Okay. Seeing none, you're excused. Thank you very much. Further witnesses on Senate Bill 231A. Seeing none, then I will conclude the public hearing on Senate Bill 231A and open a work session on Senate Bill 231A. We need the dash twos, is that right, Council?
That's correct.
Representative Gerard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 231A.
Okay, Representative Gerard moves dash two amendments into Senate Bill 231A. Discussion on the motion? Objections? Hearing none, that's allowed.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 231A as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gerard moves Senate Bill 231A as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Seeing none, may I call the roll, please?
Representative
Torres?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative
Worth,
excuse. Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Senate Bill 231A, as amended, is referred to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with Representative Gerard as carrier. And with that, I'll close the work session on that bill. Further business of the committee? Thank you. Seeing none, we're adjourned.